Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Shoshana Zuboff and Ralph Nader on how surveillance capitalism is destroying your privacy and your freedom. So, unplug Alexa and stay tuned. Now that the supermarket strike is settled, here's the new local big news. Cavi's restaurant is going out of business. The excellent restaurant has been run by the Cavagnaro family for 85 years, by Stephen Cavagnaro for the past 40 years. It is said to be one of the best restaurants in Connecticut. I have dined there 3 or 4 times over the years, and each time the food was superb. Improbable but true, Cavi's is located in Manchester. Manchester is a nice but unremarkable town east of the river, 10 miles east of Hartford. East of the river is usually a put-down. The term is used with a sneer by the bourgeoisie in the tonier towns west of the river. East of the river means wrong side of the tracks, or the sticks. The sort of place where people do not drive Mercedes SUVs. The sort of place where houses have only 2 or 3 bathrooms, and people mow their own lawns as often as not. But improbable as it seems, Cavi's restaurant has been in Manchester forever. Stephen Cavagnaro has sold Cavi's to one of Manchester's better-known residents, a Mr. Gino Auriemma. Mr. Auriemma's day job is head coach of the University of Connecticut women's basketball team. If you follow women's basketball, you may have heard of the team. I understand they're fairly good. Mr. Auriemma announced plans to transform Cavi's into an Italian steakhouse with an enlarged bar area. I'm not entirely sure what an Italian steakhouse is, but that is to be the fate of Cavi's. Naturally, my wife and I wanted to have one last fine meal at Cavi's, and we were able to make dinner reservations for one of the restaurant's last days. But it turns out you can't just pick up the phone and make a reservation anymore. Now you are compelled to go online and give a good deal of personal information to some third-party business that makes reservations for restaurants. Worse still, all this personal information, your name, address, email address, phone number, credit card information, and your intention to spend money at a certain upscale restaurant at a certain date, all that personal data will now be sold to other companies and combined with thousands of other data about me, and sold again to anyone who wants a profile of me, or sold to anyone who wants a list of, say, all the people in Hartford County who patronized an expensive restaurant in the past 3 months, are socially liberal, have no young children living at home, are not homosexual, and have had no traffic violations over the past 2 years. Years back, a cordial Cavi's employee handled my reservation request by phone, and nobody sold my personal information to anybody. Today, you can't get a table without somebody mining your personal information for profit, and you can't even tell who is doing it or where it's going. What is happening is a 1-2 punch delivered by 2 new forces. One force is digital technology. The other force, the real bad guy here, is what Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism. Alas, surveillance capitalism has gotten control of the digital technology. In a nutshell, the main purpose of the internet the main purpose of every appliance with the word smart in it, the main purpose of Alexa, of Roomba, of your cell phone, is to spy on you, to amass as much information as possible about your every move, to analyze that information, and to sell the analysis to anyone willing to pay for it. And there is nothing you can do to stop it from happening. Professor Emerita Zuboff of Harvard Business School has just published a well-received book on the subject titled The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. We'll hear excerpts of a long conversation she had on the subject with yet another luminary from provincial Connecticut, Ralph Nader. Nader and Zuboff start out by condemning those indecipherable terms of service agreement that every online service forces you to accept before you can do anything online. When you click accept, you basically renounce all your legal rights and allow Facebook or Google or your phone company or Uber or whoever to do whatever they like with your data. Here are Shoshana Zuboff and Ralph Nader.
There are a couple of key things that our listeners should know. One is the so-called terms of service contracts, the things that we have to click the little box if we're going to use the utility of the application or the website or the product, whatever it may be, the service, whatever it may be. These are fundamentally illegitimate. And despite the fact that most scholars agree on this and have agreed on this for a long time, the courts have upheld these notice and consent, so-called contracts, as lawful. But indeed, this kind of structure has a long history, and I trace it to the history of conquest. When the conquistadores first came to the Caribbean, they brought with them an edict that was fashioned by the Spanish law courts. It was called the requerimiento, the requirement. And they would go to a village where, of course, people had never seen Spaniards and they did not understand Spanish. They would read this edict, and in Spanish they would say, if you don't agree with us, we're going to kill you. And no one would know what they were talking about. And of course, the indigenous people did not want to be subjugated and they resisted. And in many cases, they were killed or tortured or in other ways turned to slaves. This is the modern equivalent of that kind of conquest. We're asked to agree with something that we cannot understand. And we essentially have no choice because there is no way to participate in society today unless we go through these channels. So all of us click on this little I agree box in a cynical way because we know we have no choice. In the past, we have thought about our participation in private organizations. The great economist Albert Hirschman wrote about the ideas of exit, voice, and loyalty, that when we're participating in private organizations, we have the option of exit, we have the option of voice, or we can agree with what's going on and be loyal to it. Well, in this case, these so-called contracts do not provide us with exit because typically we need to go forth and use the service or product. They certainly don't provide us with voice. There's no way to talk back to these companies. And very few of us feel loyalty. We simply feel trapped.
You know, this is such a deep book, Professor Zuboff, that I have to try to enlist the interest of the listeners by citing how you talk to your children about this. And on page 525, and permit me to read a section here, here's how Professor Zuboff talks to her children. Quote, when I speak to my children or an audience of young people, I try to alert them to the contingent nature of the thing that has us by calling attention to ordinary values and expectations before surveillance capitalism began its campaign of psychic numbing. Quote, this is what you say to your children. It is not okay to have to hide in your own life. It is not normal. It is not okay to spend your lunchtime conversations comparing software that will camouflage you and protect you from continuous unwanted invasion. Five trackers blocked, four trackers blocked, 59 trackers blocked, facial features scrambled, voice disguised. Quote, I tell them that the word search has meant a daring existential journey, not a finger tap to already existing answers. That, quote, friend, end quote, is an embodiment mystery that can only be forged face to face and heart to heart. And that recognition is the glimmer of homecoming we experience in our beloved's face, not, quote, facial recognition, end quote. I say that it is not okay to have our best instincts for connection and information exploited by a draconian quid pro quo that holds these goods hostage to the pervasive strip search of our lives. It is not okay for every move, emotion, utterance, and desire to be cataloged, manipulated, and then used to surreptitiously herd us through the future tense for the sake of someone else's profit. These things are brand new, I tell them. They are unprecedented. You should not take them for granted because they are not okay, end quote. Well, how many parents talk to their children that way? How many parents are afraid of their children when it comes to this new technology?
Yes, well, you know, part of the problem is we're all so busy. We're all working. We are harried. We have so many responsibilities. And for folks who are older, my age, your age, Ralph, you know, some of this stuff may seem just so distant that we don't feel authoritative about it. But I want parents to trust their instincts. I want parents to demand that their children be present. And I want parents to read about what is this frontier that we've sent our children to. We've allowed our children to be the pioneers of this digital frontier that is now owned and operated by private capital. That was not the intention at the beginning. We thought that the internet was going to be an empowering place of voice and connection and the democratization of knowledge. And for many of us as parents, we just haven't been able to keep track of what it really is and what it really means and the effect that it really has on our children. So I do have a chapter in the book called "Of Life in the Hive," where I write extensively about all the research that's been done to show exactly how this is affecting our kids. And it's not pretty. It's not pretty because our children should be, you know, developing their own inner resources and their own sense of identity and their own sense of a unique self. And those are precisely the kinds of inner experiences that are inhibited in the social network that encourages kids to compare themselves to one another and to see themselves through the other's eyes. So here's something for parents to remember. We've heard people like Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, to say, you know, if you have something to hide, then maybe you shouldn't be doing it. And my response to that is anyone who has nothing to hide is nothing. Because what we have to hide is the inner resource, the sense of our inwardness, the sense of our own identity, where we develop our understanding of right and wrong, where we develop our moral sensibility and our judgment and our courage. These are things that are hidden because they are inward and they are meant to be inward. That's what makes us strong. That's what makes us autonomous. That's what makes us able to participate as true citizens in a democratic society. So hiding is not a bad thing in that sense. It's a good thing. And we should not have to hide from the watchers.
When I hear people say they have nothing to hide, during the NSA scandal, when they violated the Fourth Amendment and put basically everybody in the United States under surveillance, so powerful are these intrusive computers, people would say, well, I have nothing to hide, but it doesn't bother me. And I said, well, let's examine that. Last time you talked to your doctor about an intimate personal problem, did you have nothing to hide? You want that all over the internet? Do you want your conversations with your clergy, with your spouse and partner? Do you want that? Do you want some interactions with your children? Do you want that to be out in the open? So once you get concrete, they start realizing what you have written, which is, quote, "If democracy is to be replenished in the coming decades, it is up to us to rekindle the sense of outrage and loss over what is being taken from us. In that, I don't mean only our personal information. What is at stake here is the human expectation of sovereignty over one's life and authorship of one's own experience," end quote. Let's talk about who can do something about this. Let's reminisce here. Nancy Reagan once told people who are addicted to drugs, just say no. Well, to what extent can people just drop out? I'm not on the internet. I don't have a Facebook account. I don't have an email. It's very hard to do a profile for my credit score with that information. So talk about the dropping out phenomena, and we'll talk about another Achilles heel of Facebook, Google, and the electronic marauders, which is their advertising revenue. Let's start with dropping off.
Well, you know, dropping off, there's certainly some things that we can do pretty easily. I've never been on Facebook and would not be for the reasons I write about in this book. But, you know, for most of us, the things that we have to do to be effective in our everyday lives, just basic participation in society, whether it's, you know, organizing interactions with other people. I mean, you don't have email and you're not on the internet, Ralph, but you have other folks around you who are, you know, buffering that. And, you know, people contacted me by email for appearing here with you today. And so most of us, we have to go through these channels in order to participate effectively, whether it's applying for a job or interacting with the IRS or...
Let's examine this. Do we have to do this or are we forced to do it? The IRS, for example, now doesn't want to send you a Social Security check. They're forcing you to go to a bank or a credit union and open up an electronic account to the profit of these institutions. There's coercion everywhere. For example, when I say to people, why don't you pay cash or check? Well, we can't because we can't rent a car. We can't use FedEx. The companies force us to do this. And so there's a coercion here that is increasing in intensity to a point where it's clear what these credit corporations want done is to eliminate cash and checks so they can have you completely incarcerated. Once they have you in a credit debit economy, you've lost your freedom. I mean, in a very concrete sense, you've lost the ability to say no. You got to pay $35 for a bounced check, which costs them $1, the bank. You got to pay all these penalties, late fees. All these fine print contracts can be changed unilaterally without your consent. They block you from going into court, which we have as a constitutional right, but we're deemed to give it up because we've signed onto these contracts that nobody reads. So I think there's a coercion here. There's a complicity, to be sure. There's a heightened awareness of overvaluing convenience, but they're creating facts on the ground, Professor Dubois.
I couldn't agree with you more, Ralph. And that's precisely why it is so difficult for the average person who's, you know, trying to get through their lives, you know, drop the kids off at daycare and get to the job and get all the other things done and manage the household. It is almost impossible to effectively participate right now and not go through these channels. But the thing is that even were that to be the case, even if we were, you know, shunting people as we've seen, you know, in the airline industry, for example, you used to be able to talk to a person and figure out your trip and so forth. A long time ago, you're shunted to the internet and you've got to do it that way because that's the low-cost solution. Even if we were coerced because of cost, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're coerced into these channels that have now become channels of surveillance for the growing power, knowledge, and power of the surveillance capitalist firms. Were it not for surveillance capitalism, this would not be as dire and dangerous as it is in your description. So there are two separate issues here. One is we're forced onto the technology because it's less expensive. But the other is in being forced into the technology, we're also being forced into the arms of a unique economic logic that thrives on the unilateral claiming of our experience for its behavioral data to create predictions about our behavior that it sells to business customers. That's how it makes its money. So we're being forced into the arms of private capital, as well as into the arms of this technological apparatus. And one of the key messages of my book is that these are not the same thing. Surveillance capitalism is not the same as digital technology. We can imagine the whole digital architecture without surveillance capitalism, but we can't imagine surveillance capitalism without the digital. So that's why I believe we have an opportunity as citizens to interrupt and outlaw surveillance capitalism as the dominant economic logic. Whereas if we did that, that would create a different kind of space for us to have true competition using digital technology in ways that we're comfortable with and that we're even happy with and that truly do enrich and empower us. You know, I think that part of this is that we've allowed the Facebooks and the Googles and the surveillance capitalist leaders to dominate the conversation. And it's been their values and their propaganda, their euphemisms, their misdirection that has really defined the situation. That's another reason why parents think it's okay and kids follow one another. So I think, you know, one of the things that's happening now, Ralph, is that I wonder if you sense this, because I do, even before the publication of my book, and I hope that my book contributes to this. But, you know, I sense that perhaps we're at the beginning of a sea change in recapturing the narrative about what all this stuff really is and what it means. There's a much greater sense of cynicism today. There's a much greater sense of articulating our mistrust. There's a much greater sense that somehow the internet and the digital in general has been hijacked by forces that are not aligned with our interests, do not have our interests at heart, do not have the interests of democracy at heart. So for me, as I write in the book, my theory of change begins with changing the public conversation, changing the narrative, changing the discussion, so that we have new words, new vocabulary, new lenses with which to see what is being imposed upon us. And through this, you know, we feel the indignant outrage that these impositions really deserve, because they are a threat to human autonomy. They take away decision rights outside of our awareness, and therefore, as you said, deprive us of the right to combat, the right to object, and ultimately, they are corrosive to democracies.
Before our time elapses, I want to talk about the advertising, because without the advertising revenue, these companies cannot dominate us the way they do. 80 to 85% of all their revenues in Google and Facebook and its subsidiaries come from these ads. And we've had people on our program who know what they're talking about saying these ads really don't work very well, that most of the people who buy have already made up their mind to buy before they see the ad on Amazon, for example. Have you looked into that? Because you taught at the Harvard Business School for years. Are the business schools looking into that? Why don't they do studies, more studies on the inefficacy of internet advertising?
Well, that's a great question. And I guess it's the, like the point in, you know, what people might call the value chain, the point where it's deemed ineffective. Because if you judge from the point of view of, for example, the two big players in online advertising, Google and Facebook, if you judge from the point of view of their revenues, it's very effective. Very effective for their market capitalization, very effective for their revenue, and almost all of their profits derive from this. The point I try to make, Ralph, is that what is this online targeted advertising? Really what it is it started with Google, the idea that they could get all these data from us They could apply their machine intelligence. They could come out with predictions, in this case, predictions of what ad we're likely to click on. They could sell those predictions to business customers, in this case, advertisers, who have a vital interest in knowing what we're going to do in the future. Now, the same structure, data, analysis, prediction products, sale to business customers in these new kind of markets that trade exclusively in predictions of human futures, the same structure is traveling all across the economy. It's no longer just Google and Facebook. In fact, right now you can read about Ford Motor Company, the birth of mass production, the birthplace of mass production, where the CEO is now saying, hey, we want to have a price earnings ratio that looks like Google and Facebook. So forget about trying to sell cars in this global slump. We're going to turn our vehicles into little surveillance pods, and we're going to get all these user data, and we're going to monetize that. And that's going to be our new road to profit margins. So this is toothpaste out of the tube, Ralph. It's everywhere. It's the insurance industry, finance, entertainment, transportation, every product that has the word smart in front of it, every service that has the word personalized in front of it. So that's why I think the thing that we've got to get out in front of now is the economic logic itself, that it is illegitimate to unilaterally take people's experience and turn it into data, that it's illegitimate to turn those data into predictions of what we're going to do, that it's illegitimate to sell those predictions, that indeed these futures markets that trade exclusively in predictions of our behavior are themselves illegitimate and a gross disfiguring of the whole idea of capitalism and what it has traditionally been and how it has managed to establish an equilibrium with democratic societies over the past century.
And on that scary note, we must end our excerpts from a most interesting conversation between Professor Shoshana Zuboff and Ralph Nader. For the original recording, which I have much condensed, thanks to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From east of the river in darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, suggesting illegitimi non carborundum. In solidarity, there is strength. And please tune in again next week. Till then.